I am Molly Schwartzberg. I'm a curator here in Special Collections, just down the hallway. And I'm very, very happy to welcome you here to our panel today on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which is the producer of the Virginia Festival of the Book. Before we get too far, I'd like to ask you all to please silence your cell phones. Silence them, but do not turn them off, because, of course, all of you are going to be tweeting about this event at hashtag VABook2016. That's the official hashtag for the festival. So cell phones on silent. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the sponsor for this event, Les Yeux du Monde and Lydia Cato Gosman Archive for Picasso and Modernist Studies, and I'm terribly sorry if I just garbled that. And they have sponsored this event quite appropriately. Please note that the festival is free of charge, but not free of cost. Please go online and give back, or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni, and support the festival so that we can continue to sustain it into the future. Also, equally important, if not more important, fill out your evaluation forms. They are at the back of the room. Oh, can you hear me better now? Should I be leaning in? I'm so sorry. Please fill out a paper evaluation form before you leave, or you can complete it online at the festival's website. These evaluation forms are really important so that we can make sure that we continue to produce events that draw audiences and your support. Also note that books are available at this event in the back of the room, and our authors will be available to sign copies of their book, and we ask that instead of crowding the podium to excitedly ask questions, you crowd them at the back of the room to do so, so that the folks organizing the event can prep for the next session. Okay, I think that's all the logistics I had to get through. Now we get to the meat of our day. Today's program celebrates the publication of two wonderful new biographies. Leslie Francis's You Come To, My Journey with Robert Frost, and Nancy Princenthal's Agnes Martin, Her Life and Art. Now, at first glance, these two books may seem to really only have in common the fact that they're 20th century figures for whom these are new biographies. And I was so excited as I started reading these two books in tandem, back and forth, to start discovering some incredible, just wonderful, marvelous synergies and symmetries between these two lives. Now, how are they so different? We have a biography of a poet and one of an artist, one of a man, one of a woman, one of a narrative poet, and one of a minimalist abstract artist, one of a poet for whom there are already in existence numerous competing biographies, and one of an artist for whom this is the first biography. But the symmetries, I think, and the synergies really transcend these differences in powerful ways, and I think that these are some of the things that are going to come out, possibly, from these talks. And if not from the talks, definitely when you go and read the books, if you have not yet. First, both of them are very much about, at various points in their narratives, about education, formal education, and the roles that working in formal education has had for all the figures represented in these books. The children who are educated by these people, whether the children are in institutions or children in the family, and also discipline, the disciplinarian work of the teacher and the discipline of making art. Both of these books are about profoundly productive individuals who worked to some extent in relation to their own struggles with mental illness and mental difficulty, either of their own or in their families. And for both, this has been a struggle in terms of how to interpret the art in relation to or in contradiction to or separately from that mental illness. There is always the danger of a slippage between mental illness and art and creating a simplistic causality between the two. And both of these biographers are very concerned with that problem. Both are books that end up being about women, about powerful, energetic, independent women working across multiple generations. Both are also about peripatetic artists who moved around a lot in their lives, developed deeply American identities, and are deeply associated with the very specific American places in which they resided, and their artwork is interpreted very heavily in relation to those geographies. And finally, both books are very concerned with the idea of innocence and knowledge. The innocence that Martin celebrates in her work, and the innocence that is arguably, if we look at Frances's biography, not considered carefully enough in studies of Robert Frost, where his relationship to children, and specifically the children in his own family, are arguably not regarded as important as they are. So I'd like to kind of start you off with those as thoughts that I came out of both of these books with, and that I hope will maybe come up again in our discussion. Each of our writers is going to speak about their project, and then we will have a Q&A session at the end, and I encourage you to think about questions as we go. Our first speaker will be Leslie Lee Francis. She has lectured and published extensively on her grandfather, the poet Robert Frost. She received her AB from Radcliffe and her PhD in Romance Languages from Duke, and she has served as a professor of Spanish language, literature, and history, and on the staff of the American Association of University Professors. Nancy Princenthal, who will speak second, is a Brooklyn-based writer. Her recent books include Agnes Martin, Her Life and Art, which won the 2015 Penn Literary Award in Biography, and Hannah Wilke by Prestel, 2010. A contributing editor of Art in America, Princenthal teaches at the School of Visual Arts in New York. So without further ado, I give you first Leslie Lee Francis.
Greetings. This is the first day of the festival. Can you hear me in the back there? You sure? Okay. I first want to just say it's wonderful to be in Charlottesville. My daughter graduated from law school here, and I've come down a number of times with our Frost group that we have, and Nancy and Molly has been to several of those. You didn't mention my symposium, no. Okay. So I know a number of people in Charlottesville. It's a wonderful town to live in. I enjoyed the train ride yesterday. I didn't drive for a change, and I took the train, and it was kind of nice. And there were very few people on the train, and I had to have them tell me when I was there in Charlottesville, and there I am. So thank you all for coming today. It is the opening of the festival, right? We're opening it here. I want to say something about the library. In this symposium that I help run every year for the last 22 years, one of the things that I was most concerned about when we started it was that the librarians from special collections, such as the excellent one that they have at the University of Virginia, that they be included. So naturally, I invited any special collections librarian that had a good Frost collection would have an interest in that. And so this, I go back to the time, back in the day, which I'm learning to say a lot lately. Back in the day, it was Joan St. Crane that I knew, and C. Waller Barrett. Does everybody here know who C. Waller Barrett was? Well, it was a wonderful couple. What is his wife's name? I just learned it. Michael, what was her name?
Cornelia.
Michael and C. Waller Barrett came here often to the university, and I was privileged to get to know them. And C. Waller Barrett told me that he was a businessman up in New York, and he hated to go to lunch with his colleagues. It was found it so boring. He'd see them all day. He didn't want to have lunch with them. So he started going around to the used bookstores, and they all got to know him. And they said, Mr. Barrett, we have something we think you'd find very interesting. And that every time you'd go to lunch, you'd get another something, and then he started to make money. So, of course, he bought them. And his collection, I know the Frost collection, is one of the, if not the best in the country. Maybe Dartmouth might compete for that. But he also had a wonderful collection of Faulkner. And who else did Waller Barrett bring to?
So many.
Okay. Well, the one I know is the Frost one, of course, and I've been deeply involved with that. And then Michael Plunkett, of course, I got to know when he was heading up the special collections. And he and his wife, Anne Marie, are very good friends of mine. And did a wonderful job here. And now we have Molly. And who's coming next? You don't know, right?
Nobody.
Nobody. Right? Are you being interviewed? I hope so. So I want to thank all those people that have made my connection with the University of Virginia very important. And most recently, of course, is my book. And she has a copy of my book. I don't have mine right with me. But the press has been wonderful to me, and some of them are here, I believe. I don't know who's here, somewhere back there. There you are. Good. Thank you for coming. And it's been a pleasure to work with them. I've told them that the print is too small, and they better get a paperback out with larger print. So I can read my own book. I can put it on Kindle, however. And I do enjoy the book. I think it's wonderfully put together. I love the photographs, the way they came out. And I hope that those of you who get the book will enjoy it. If you see the cover picture, you'll see immediately that I'm in the photo. And if you can't figure out which one I am, then I can't help you. I can't help you. It was taken on New Hampshire Avenue in downtown D.C., in front of a school that my mother was teaching in called the King Smith Studio School. And a woman who was teaching photography there would follow and became a very close friend of my mother's, and she, named Masha Arms, she became a very good professional photographer. So she would take pictures of us any chance she got. We never had a camera in the family. But that picture she took one day that I was just walking along with my grandfather, and my sister was with us, and we had lollipops, if you can believe it. And he was carrying a copy of the we think it's the Washington Post, we're not sure. But it was a very wonderful photo, and it was one completely, you know, a candid photo. It wasn't one planned at all. But she took lots of pictures of Frost, and they're very good. They're now in a museum somewhere in Massachusetts. But this is a wonderful collection here, and the press is a wonderful press, and I've been delighted to be connected to all of that. Now I want to say something about the book itself. I'm going to be brief because we have a lot of things going on here. I want to hear Nancy, and I want to get your questions. But I think first I should say what for me is the most important thing about the book, the emotion that's behind it. And the emotion behind it is very simple, really. It's not complicated. It's the love of books and the love of poetry. Now, I feel free to say it's not a book for everyone. I can see someone who's not used to poetry, and I think a lot of people are scared of poetry. I try to tell people it's a slow art to enjoy. If you don't start when you're very young, it's hard. But even if you start later, it's hard. And I think that you have to get over the fear of it, that if you don't like a poem that you've read, go to another poem. Don't feel you have to agonize over what does it mean. And I have this problem when I teach Frost to older students, which I do now that I've retired. I find that they are scared to just read the poem and see what the poem says to them, which is the most important. They can remember what their first grade teacher said about the road not taken. And it's all wrong, usually, you know. But never mind. They're so scared of contradicting some elementary school teacher or something. But my request to all of you is just to read the poem and let the poem speak to you. And if it doesn't speak to you, move on. It's not a big deal. I mean, I refuse to read two books about Ulysses by James Joyce in order to understand Ulysses. If I can't understand Ulysses, I'm just not going to worry about it. I'm not going to worry about it. It may be my problem, but never mind. So that emotion of loving books, loving to handle real books, by the way, which is a fading art, I'm afraid. I think the libraries have become concerned. They have a space problem, so they want to digitalize everything. But let's not go down that road right now. So the emotion that's driving it is just that, a love of books and a love of poetry. So you're going to find a lot of that in the book, a lot of poems by other poets besides Robert Frost, and including poems by my mother, and I sprinkled in one or two of mine, just kind of cheating there. But then we get into the question of what's prompted me to write the book in the first place, or write anything about my grandfather. So I'm going to make that very brief. But I'll mention that my mother went with her father. My mother was Leslie Frost. She was the eldest of the surviving children of Robert Frost. He had four surviving children. His firstborn, a boy, died when he was 4 years old, and then there were some miscarriages later on. But the four children who survived, my mother was the eldest. She was born in 1899 and died in 1963. And Frost became a secondary thing with her. She loved books also, and it began to be in her blood. There's something she just couldn't get rid of. She went to college, three different colleges, actually, never graduated. But she had a very active life, and you'll see a lot about her in the in the book, and I want to pick up on something that Molly said. She said there are very strong women in these two books that we're discussing here. And that was a theme that I picked up on deliberately. It was a deliberate theme. Because I think that often with women, especially back in the day, which I'm learning to say quite a bit lately, women were not given the higher positions as artists, that they have acquired at least a little higher position over the years. They were often hired as secondary in a newspaper. They would be literary editors, perhaps, or they would write some poems that they had trouble publishing, that kind of thing. So some of those that encouraged Frost from the very beginning, and I'm going to name them, but you'll have to read the book to find out about them because I don't have time here. But in particular, of course, Robert Frost's wife, and I will say a little more about Eleanor. And how they got, how they ended up getting married. That's a love story, so I can tell that as a separate little story. But I really want to introduce this exactly. But remember, they moved onto a farm in Derry, New Hampshire. Frost was born in San Francisco, and his father died when he was 11. His father and mother brought him back to Lawrence. And his sister, with Jeannie and Robert, they came back to Lawrence, Massachusetts, she was widowed, of course, but her husband had lived in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And his mother became a school teacher there, and Robert was educated primarily at home, as was Jeannie. But then he went to high school in Lawrence, and the other day I heard Bernie, have all of you got the Bern here? No, I won't ask. Bernie Sanders was saying that the high schools were terrible, that the standards were way down and everything was wrong with the high schools, and therefore we have to give these poor children who are so neglected, we have to give them a free college education. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, why don't we do something about K-12 first? And then when they come out of high school, I mean, Frost had a high school in Lawrence, Massachusetts that was incredible. When he had, Greek and Latin, and they had a marvelous journal, a bulletin rather. His first poems appeared in there. He became editor of the bulletin. He was on every athletic team you can imagine. He was the big boy on campus. He was class secretary. He did the class hymn. He did the class poems, all that. But it was a very thorough, disciplined education. And when he came out of there, he really didn't like college. He didn't like college. It felt like he didn't have time to walk. He didn't have time to think. It was all rote memory. He refers to Harvard, where he did very well when he was at Harvard. His father was Phi Beta Kappa there. But he refers to it, in later life, he refers to Harvard as where he was a patient. Of course, half-chokingly, he was very proud of his father's connection. But he didn't enjoy college. He went to Dartmouth first, so I have to mention that. And there he was hazed, and he barricaded himself in his room, and he stayed a couple of months and just walked off. He never told anybody he was leaving. Of course, now they're very proud of the fact that he stopped by. And he passed the exams into Harvard twice. First when he got out of high school right at that time, and then again later when he decided he had to make a living to support a family. And he thought he better go back to college. So he went to Harvard then. He stayed for almost 2 years. And then his mother became ill. She died of cancer. So he never finished his degree. And when he gets honorary degrees at Oxford and Cambridge and Durham and Dublin, he would say when he got up to speak, I was there for one of them, he got up and said, I've got my education by degrees, he said. And then he'd pause and say, degradation. But I have to tell this little story about him too, because it does say something about those critics who said he was a myth maker, that he made himself into a myth. I want to take exception to that and explain how disorganized this man was. He was very disorganized. He had no practical sense about how to become a published poet or anything. He never had never met another poet before he was published. So when they were up in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and he had become a popular teacher in Derry, New Hampshire, at the Pinkerton Academy. By the way, if you want to visit an interesting high school, that is a very interesting high school. And some of the politicians were going there the last few weeks, I noticed. Anyway, he was invited by the head of the Pinkerton Academy to go up to Plymouth, what was then the Plymouth Normal School. And they piled on him all kinds of teaching assignments, like childhood teaching or childhood learning and all this kind of thing. And so they were staying in the principal's house with the four children, and it was a chaos. Eleanor never liked the kitchen, and the kitchen was a mess, and so everything was a mess. So they got together in the kitchen, because that's where the family would meet. This was in 1912. And they got together in the kitchen, and they talked about what they wanted to do. And Robert said, no, I want to follow two students of mine from Pinkerton Academy who got married and went to Vancouver. And they went and they dropped out of college. They dropped out of Middlebury. And they went up to Vancouver and out in the woods, and there they got their writing done, and nobody bothered them. He said, oh, that's what I want to do. And he knew them very well. They stayed a lifetime friends. So he was voting for Vancouver. But Eleanor said, no, 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 no. I want to go to England because I want to live under thatch. This was their idea of living poetically, you see. She wanted to live under thatch. In point of fact, they did go to England because they tossed a coin, literally. And this is a literal, this is not figurative. Literally, they tossed a coin and England came up, okay? So they were in England from 1912 to 1915. And she didn't get to live under thatch until just before they came back. They moved. They had no money. It was a terrible money situation. But they moved into the house of another poet. It had thatch on it, thank goodness. So she did get that way. But he never intended to publish in England. It was not in his thinking, even. He wanted to go where he could write. I mean, it's as simple as that. And then, he saw another advantage, that this was the birthplace of English lyric poetry. I mean, he knew that. He had Paul Graves' book, and he'd read all that poetry, and he was delighted to go where they were. He wanted to meet Hardy. He wanted to meet Shaw. And I forget, there was a third one. Oh, and Yeats. Those are the three men he wanted to meet. I don't have time to tell you about all that. But he did get to meet all but Hardy. Hardy was a recluse by that time, and he wrote some very good poetry. And Frost was very interested in drama. How much minutes? 5 minutes. Well, I'm going to have to skip a lot. Anyway, what really got me started here was that Frost was invited by the government to go down to São Paulo, Brazil, to take part in the World Congress of Writers. This was in 1954, if I have the date right. And my mother went with him because she knew Spanish, but she didn't know Portuguese. And, of course, they were going to São Paulo. And he had a very good time. He was horrified at the long plane trip. It was a very long plane trip. He said it was the first time he'd ever flown like that. But he was very popular with the press. Faulkner went with him. Faulkner, on the other hand, did not like the press. Faulkner didn't like really anybody to talk to. So he went off in his hotel room. But my mother, when they came back, they also got in another plane and flew to Lima so that Frost could indulge a hobby of his, which was the love of archaeology. And that's really where I wanted to say that was the beginning of my interest in writing about my grandfather, because when they came back, my mother brought this big pile of papers, mostly clippings, from the press in Brazil and Lima about my grandfather and about the World Congress of Writers. And she dumped it on my desk and said, do something with this, because she didn't read Portuguese. Well, I could read Portuguese. I didn't know it very well. But it was a delightful account of this. And just quickly on the Faulkner thing, they would interview him in there. They finally got to him in his hotel room. Then he left for the States for a wedding that he had to go to. But he often had a martini in his hand. I don't think he would be surprised if I said that. And he walked over to the window, and he looked out, and this is all in Portuguese. He looked out, and he said, my, how Chicago has changed. That was the end of the interview, anyway. But Frost himself had a good time, and he enjoyed the archaeological thing a great deal. So that got me started on writing about his interest in archaeology and pre-colonial history, and I did quite a bit on that. He also had an interest in, and by the way, his first poem that he wrote on the campus of the high school was called La Noche Triste, and again, I don't have time to go into all that, but as you can tell, it's a Spanish title, and I should ask you. See, if this were a longer lecture, I would ask you what it means. You're supposed to know that, and then you're supposed to know that it's also the name of the night that Cortez spent in 1520 trying to defeat Moctezuma. And they were defeated the first time around, not the second time around. But they spent the night around a tree or inside the tree, depending on which legend you believe, and with a few Spanish soldiers they had. And Frost was very much on the side of the Indians, so he wrote his very first poem on campus there. It's a ballad, and it's not a very good one, and so it's not collected. It's called La Noche Triste. And he had a strong, and because Nancy's going to be speaking now, I wanted to say that he had a strong interest in art, and that there's a whole section in the book about that. He was very, very close to J.J. Lankes, who was a graphic artist who did a couple of his books, who was a real artist. Frost tried to help him. It was a man who was very hard to help. And he lived very, rather primitively, but he did beautiful, beautiful art. J.J. Lankes, and I mentioned, of course, James Chapin was another very close friend of his, did a lot of portraits and so on, a lot of portraits of children in particular. And these people were family friends. Now, Wyeth was not a family friend, but Frost greatly admired his painting. And again, there's a long story about that. They had a big exhibit in Washington. In the catalog, they talk about the Frost connection. Another theme in the book, I'm going to pass over all of this now because of the time, but there's a strong development of the at-home schooling, I should call it, at-home schooling that the four Frost children had, and the interaction, that was a theme that really interested me, was the interaction between Frost and his children. And the journals that I want you to look at afterwards or might come up in the question and answer period is this New Hampshire's Child. This is the Virginia copy of it. New Hampshire's Child, the dairy journals of Leslie Frost. And they're reproduced in facsimile. She learned to write before she was 5 years old and kept the journals as part of her at-home education. But I don't have time to go into that either. I was going to talk a little bit about the Eleanor Frost as a great love story and the strength of these women, very strong, independent women. I'll just name them here. But his mother, Belle Moody, of course, from Scotland, his wife, Eleanor, who was a real equal with him, and she was very smart, and she graduated from college in 3 years. And Susan Hayes Ward, who was his first editor, published his first poem, My Butterfly, on the front page of the New York Independent. And Harriet Monroe, who founded Poetry Magazine in 1912. 1 minute left. Okay, that's it, folks. Amy Lowell was another one that he had. Well, she kind of discovered him. She was in England and found his book and got him published in the States even before he got back. He was well known by the time he returned from England, much to his own surprise. I was going to read various poems in this, but maybe Molly will ask me a question where I can read actually one or two poems. Yeah, we can't do it now. I was going to read The Pasture and one of the poems he wrote for his children and The Road Not Taken, but you don't need to have that read to you. And then as a love poem, I was going to read Never Again Would Bird's Song Be the Same. Because a love story is a very nice story, independent of everything else. I also had the pleasure of being here at the inauguration, which is another story. It's in the book, though. The inauguration, and I was working in the American Embassy in Madrid when he went over to get honorary degrees at all those universities that I mentioned. And I was lucky to be there for that, for the Oxford and Cambridge part of it anyway. So it was an exciting time for me, too. But he wasn't one you could just sit down with casually in the living room and sit on his knee. But there is one photo in the book where I am sitting on his knee. So when I teach adult classes, they always say, did you get to know your grandfather at all? So I always show them that photo because I'm sitting on his knee. My sister's sitting on the other knee, but never mind. Thank you all.
Also want to thank you all for coming. That's going to be a very hard act to follow. It's an honor to be following Leslie Lee Francis and her really quite wonderful book about several extraordinary women, including herself and her amazing mother. I also want to thank everyone connected with the festival for putting this together, and Molly for her wonderful introduction. I'm going to guess that many of you are not familiar with Agnes Martin. Agnes Martin was an artist who drew attention in the 1960s for abstract paintings that are austere but radiant, I think innocent. The word that Molly used is an excellent word for her painting. It's a word she chose herself. Martin's mature works consist of 6-foot squares with grids and stripes. Really, that's about what it is. 6-foot square paintings, hand-ruled lines, grids at first, stripes afterward. It is, and you're going to, those of you who don't know her work will have to trust me on this, and really rather extraordinary experience to be face-to-face with them. I'm actually not going to apologize for not having images. I thought maybe I should, because the work reproduces rather horribly. It's work that you have to have a first-hand experience with. I hear a giggle. It's true. It's work that suppresses all associations to people, places, and things, and yet it has struck many, many people as having really considerable power, even some sublimity. She worked for many years in obscurity, 20 years really without being seen at all. On the other hand, her work, if you are interested, is the subject of an exhibition that opened at the Tate in London last summer. It's opening in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in about 4 weeks, and will be coming to the Guggenheim Museum in my hometown in October of this year. So you will have an opportunity to see her work if it grabs your interest. I hope it will. I was first drawn to her work in the early 1970s when I was 1 year old. I was in high school. But I've been interested in her work for a very long time and first had an opportunity to write about her work when I was in college. I wrote a senior thesis about Agnes Martin, and here comes a story that I've told many times to my students. And in the course of preparing the thesis, I wrote a letter to Agnes Martin, which required all of my courage, and I gave her a long list of critics who had written about her work to that point. And I said, "So, Ms. Martin, which of these critics have got it right?" And she wrote back to me in longhand on, you know, on notebook paper, which surprised me. Where's the typewriter? Saying essentially, forget all that. Forget the critics. Follow your heart. Trust your intuition. Trust your inspiration. You will understand my work. And I thought, great. What do I do with that? I'm supposed to be writing an academic paper, and she tells me to trust my intuition. Not very handy. So, you know, of course, years later, I understood that she had given me a great gift. It took me a long time to recognize the gift that she had given me. And I've also come to understand that some of the critical reception and the curatorial support that she had been given is part of the Agnes Martin story. So I accept everything that she says about following your heart. It's a hard lesson that has to be learned over and over again. But I did find that starting with the very first critical responses and reception, people like Dori Ashton, who's writing for the Times, Donald Judd, who is a minimalist sculptor, were important. Some of her first shows in the middle 1960s included an op art show, which, trust me, if you've seen the work, it is so quiet. The idea that she would be included with work that, you know, sends your head spinning is an interesting way to frame it as a first step. But she was included in landmark minimalist shows. She's often included with minimalist painters. She was not of the minimalist generation. She was too old for them. She wasn't a minimalist by disposition. She shared the abstract expressionist commitment to internal experience, and especially to expressing greater truths, to expressing states of experience that are fundamental to all of us. So I did ultimately undertake the very precious job of seeing how I could relate her life to her work. I wasn't interested in aspects of her life that didn't have a bearing on her work. So here goes. I'll try to be fast. Agnes Martin was born in 1912 in Saskatchewan. Her grandparents in Saskatchewan, Canada, the prairies. Her grandparents came onto the prairie in covered wagons. Her early life could have been a story by Laura Ingalls Wilder. It was tough. If you remember Laura Ingalls Wilder, those are actually tough days. Her father died when she was 2 years old. Her mother was an extremely resilient and also quite tough disciplinarian, extremely resilient woman who kept the family of four children going through some rather desperate times. Martin's school years were spent in Vancouver. And then she came to the United States, to Bellingham, Washington, in 1931. I had the good fortune to go up to Saskatchewan, to Macklin, the town where she was raised, or not where she was raised, where she was born and spent the first probably 4 or 5 years of her life. And it was helpful. You see from the size of the sky, from the clarity of the light, from the size of the landscape, some aspects that have a bearing on her work, although she always denied that there is a connection to the landscape in her work. All of those things are there. You also see something that I only discovered when I came home, which is that it's completely impossible to photograph. I took all these photographs, and so did a much better photographer who was with me, and I looked at those shots when I came home, and I thought, there's nothing to see. So what I learned, you know, it's just flat and brown and a big blue sky. Her work is like that, too. It can't be photographed, as I said, and it is an immersive, you know, sort of face-to-face, body-to-body experience. 6 foot square is the size she chose because it's, you know, it's an arm span. It was a size that she could manage. And when you see her work, you can imagine her face-to-face with it, you know, that would be the field of her vision. That would be what she could see. Her early life, her early adult life, was spent figuring out essentially how to support herself. She undertook to be a teacher, first taking a teaching certificate in Washington and working in one-room schoolhouses. This is the depths of the Depression, early 1930s, one-room schoolhouses in the Pacific Northwest. And then in what I think of as the first of some rather amazing acts of determination and courage, she came out to New York and enrolled in Teachers College. So New York, 1941, Teachers College was her first experience of a big, big city. But she, and this is an interesting, unexplored topic, had spent some time in and near Seattle. And Seattle at that time in the late 20s, early 30s, going into the late 30s, was really a very interesting, lively center of modernism, of modern art, of avant-garde art, really cutting-edge art. And the influences on the West Coast were coming not just from European modernism, but also very significantly from Asia. So the West Coast artists were early in bringing over the influence of Asian spiritual systems, of calligraphy, of things that worked their way into the New York modernism only a couple decades later, for the most part. And Agnes had the opportunity to absorb those influences when she was in Seattle. She only spent a single year in New York that first time, 41 to 42. Her funds ran out. She did some more teaching, itinerant teaching, back to the Pacific Northwest, around the East Coast. And then she made her first trip down to New Mexico. And New Mexico, a landscape very much like Saskatchewan, high desert, dry, gorgeous, unbelievable light. Those of you who have been there, it's, unique landscape. And also a very, very lively cultural scene then as now, and actually had been since the early years of, since D.H. Lawrence in the teens, had been a magnet for vanguard writers as well as visual artists. There are a great number of visual artists who came through. Mabel Dodge Lewin was a patron of the arts who brought great numbers of artists from New York. Also artists who were living on the West Coast came down. There is a tremendous influence of Native American art. All of these things Martin completely denied the influence of. Her work is not about textiles. It's about a very abstract states of joy, states of innocence, states of pure happiness. These are states that she gave title, that uses titles for her painting toward the end of her life. She went back to New York, back to New Mexico, and settled in New Mexico for about 10 years between the late 1940s and the end of the 1950s. And during that period, there are wonderful photographs of Agnes Martin and her fellow students, and then she quickly became a teacher, setting out off on horseback to paint the landscape. This is when John Marin was out there painting the landscape, Marsden Hartley, other modernists. So there was a very strong connection to, you know, an old Western idea of what art was meant to be. She was painting rather academic work at the time, but very quickly cycled through a number of different influences, including the Surrealists, including she would soon make work that was very heavily indebted to Mark Rothko. And by the end of the 50s, she was painting pretty challenging work. Not yet the grids and stripes, pretty challenging work. And Betty Parsons, who's the primary dealer of the Abstract Expressionist generation, frequent visitor to Taos, came out and made an offer to Martin that she made to other artists, which was, I will show your work, which is a big deal, very prominent gallery, but you have to live in New York. You can't do it out here. Martin said, okay, I'll give it a try. And she moved to New York in 57 and established herself in a community at Coent called Coenti Slip Community, named for one of its tiny little streets, which is in a very still, isolated part of Lower Manhattan. It was then right on the edge of a very active working seaport. It, on the other side is Wall Street, you know, couldn't be a more disjunctive kind of community. Completely empty at night, very disconnected from the rest of the city, and also sort of deliberately very distinct from the other vanguard community that at that time was the most important in New York. That would be the Abstract Expressionists, who hung out on 10th Street, which from the seaport is uptown. So some of the things that Martin quickly absorbed when she was there were the influences of some of her neighbors, who included Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, Ellsworth Kelly, Jack Youngerman. People like Rauschenberg were experimenting with assemblage, with using found objects, seaport kinds of stuff, to put together their work. I also feel that it was very important to her, Robert Indiana was one of her neighbors as well, that all of her lines, the lines that organize the structure, the skeleton of her work, are hand-drawn in pencil. And that hand-drawn pencil line, to me, is a line that's very close to the line of writing. There is no writing in the sense of words, written language, in her work. But I do believe that there's a connection to an experience of inner thought, that line of thought, as I think of it, that runs through her work, is really central to its experience. And you can see it even underneath these clouds of color that come into it from starting in the 70s and on until the end of her life. So I think it was important that there were other artists who were experimenting right next door to her with the integration of written language with visual language, reading people like Gertrude Stein. Robert Indiana was making sign-based paintings. Two of the artists that Martin was closest with when she was, that she was closest with when she was in New York, Lenore Tawney and Krissa, are both making work that involved both collage and language. It is also important to an account of the Coenti Slip community that it was welcoming to gay men and women, which was true of Taos, remains true of Taos, and had been true since the early part of the 20th century. So that was one of the things that wasn't talked about much, certainly not in the 50s and 60s, when it was quite uncomfortable to be out. Neither was it something that Agnes talked about. It is very difficult to see any relationship between the choices she made in her art and the choices she made in her personal life. She did not consider herself as a feminist, and she was no kind of political activist in any term. She did talk some about the sources of her work, which came from something that she very deliberately called my inspiration. And her inspirations were very particular. They came to her fully formed. So when she was about to paint a painting, she needed to wait for an image to appear to her mind's eye, exact in every detail but small. So the job was to blow it up. And sometimes she blew it, blowing it up. Those paintings were discarded. Otherwise, she says that she followed those inspirations to the T. This is how she described it. When I had an inspiration for the grids, I was thinking of innocence, and the image was a grid. That was it. I thought, my God, am I supposed to paint that? She describes herself as being sort of, in some sense, helpless in the face of these Inspirations, which certainly in other ways doesn't describe her character at all. It does, on the other hand, lead to the discussion of the ways in which she was at the mercy of things that her mind did that weren't so conducive to painting. She did have paranoid schizophrenia. She was treated and medicated for it all her adult life. She was also hospitalized several times. And I think I'm saying this because I think it's the effort to regulate the voices that she heard. She was susceptible all her adult life to hearing internal voices that were personified. The effort to regulate them, to find order and calm in her life, does have a contributory role in her painting. I think it would be dead wrong to talk about her as someone whose inner demons had some creative role in generating her work, which is the romantic stereotype of how mental illness relates to creativity. Sadly for her, it was also an assumption that was current in the 1960s when she was in New York, when she had a couple of particularly serious psychotic breaks. The idea in the vanguard culture that schizophrenia was the choice of a creative person could make to be sane in a crazy world, that it was a sort of act of resistance, did not serve her very well. Neither really did Freudian psychoanalysis, which is one of the treatments on hand. Neither did Thorazine and electroshock therapy, all of which she was given. And although she refused to talk about openly, of course, some of her close friends knew about mental illness, she did talk about struggles openly in the writing for which she is, among some people, as revered as she is for her painting. She talked very openly about the struggles, with what she called terror, the dragon that pounds the inner streets, loneliness, depression. The solitary life is full of terrors is something that she includes in writing that is, in other passages, exquisitely lyrical and, frankly, in some passages, kind of nuts. So you can see in her writing with a clarity that she didn't have that she didn't permit herself in the work, what she was up against. Her success in the face of it, I think, is the more remarkable. Nonetheless, she did find herself compelled to leave New York at the end of the 60s, 1967. She just had it. There are a lot of explanations given for why she left. She was very close with Ad Reinhardt, king of the renunciators, he's often called, the painter who's best known for basically all black paintings. There's actually a cruciform shape in all of them, but the first glance is all black. She had also lost her loft. Any of you who worked in studios know that the loss of a studio can be devastating. And she had also gotten an NEA grant, which allowed her to go out west, which is what she did. And it was after an 18-month period of wandering that she again found herself back in New Mexico, which is... she had a vision. She wound up there. And that's where she spent the rest of her life, mostly pursuing the work that she had started to develop when she was in New York. The paintings became more open. They became more suffused with color. She experimented with some excursions from work on canvas. She made a couple of movies. She conceived of an earthwork never built, both very interesting digressions from what people imagine to be a life of unvarying commitment to unvarying formats. And her final drawing, she died in 2004 in Taos, is a very beautiful, looks like a contour drawing, a blind contour drawing of a potted plant. So you see at the end of her life the effort, in a sense, that it cost her to suppress the reference to nature that is, I think, sublimated, that is so clear, even if not represented in the main body of her work. So I was going to read a little bit from the book, but I will not have that chance. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, Well, thank you both so much for valiantly attempting to even begin talking about these two extremely rich works in a very short amount of time. I mean, I think it's really, really hard to do. And actually, that's one of the, maybe one of the questions that I thought would be worth talking about. And while the audience is mulling over, I'll just get us started off with a question. And after that, we'll take raised hands. But I wanted to ask you both a little bit about one of the qualities of both of these biographies that really struck me, is that neither one of them is really just a biography of one person. Nancy, your book, while primarily about Agnes Martin and really an attempt to build a biography based on quite limited sources, especially for the earlier parts of Martin's life, is also kind of a primer for certain parts of American art history in the 20th century, especially this community at the Coenties Slip neighborhood in New York. And I found it to contain what I thought were almost capsule biographies of Chryssa and Lenore Tawney, in particular the two women artists you mentioned. And it becomes an opportunity to provide these women with their place as well through the biography of Martin. And Leslie, in your book, it really is a series of biographies and memoirs, both of yourself, your mother, various other family members, as well as Robert Frost, who actually sort of falls into the background and becomes, dare I say it, not quite as interesting as the other people who begin to come to the surface as hugely important influences on his life and work. Through the fact of how he was influencing them, whether his wife or daughter or grandchildren or other members of the family. And I'm interested in how this process of writing these biographies helped you think a little bit about biography, and if you can say something about the extent to which you thought of these as biographies of multiple people as you were working, and how that was impacted by the subject matter that you had chosen.
Who's first? Who's I?
You go.
You want me to go first?
Okay.
Is this working?
Should be.
Can you hear me back there?
I don't know if this is working. Is it?
Oh, yeah. It's on.
Can you hear me back there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, of course, I'd have to quickly answer the drama in Robert Frost is the poetry itself. And I didn't have time to read any of the poems, so I ran out of time. But he was not a man that liked to move around and, that wasn't central to his life. The poetry was the center of his life in many, many ways that I hope I developed in the book. But there were some very interesting people around him, and I think one of the things that is neglected in some of the other biographies is the importance of the women that were a part of his life. I mean, Eleanor always gets short treatment, and there's a reason why. She married in the old tradition of being a big supporter of his poetry, but the love story that I started to tell earlier, didn't have time to finish it, was that when they both graduated the same year from Lawrence, Massachusetts High School, he was named valedictorian of his class. And that was no surprise. He was the man on campus and also a very good student, excellent student. Well, Eleanor was an excellent student also. But she wasn't the kind that would be on the football team or anything like that. She had missed a year of school from rheumatic fever and was a year older than he was and very mature in her thinking. So, and shy, and also very shy. So he said he would be valedictorian of the class on one condition. Oh, whoa. He had a condition. That condition was that she be named co-valedictorian. And that's the first time that ever happened at Lawrence High School, and it never happened again as far as I know. No one has corrected me on that. And so she was named co-valedictorian. The poor woman had to get up and give a speech and everything, you know. And her grades were slightly better than his. Her grades were slightly better. But she had not been on the football team, the baseball team, the debating society. She wasn't editor of the school bulletin. She wasn't poet, you know, class poet or any of that. But he said he wouldn't be that unless she were named. And so that was the way the love match started. Okay, they graduated from the high school, and he said, now... Of course, this again was back in the day when people did get married right out of high school, okay? He said, let's get married, you know. That was the whole deal. No, 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 she says. I'm going to college. You're going where? You know, that was it. So she goes off to Canton, New York, which is in the northernmost part of New York, near on the Canadian border, If anyone's been to Canton, New York, you know that it's far away. And she went to St. Lawrence University, and she graduated in 3 years, and I have copies of her transcript at home. She took everything. I mean, she was a very serious student and a very smart woman. Now, what she didn't like was domestic stuff. She didn't like the kitchen. I told you that earlier. So that was a problem. When she graduated, I have to say before they graduated, and she's very important in his life, and she was an important woman in his life. Before she graduated, he put together and had privately printed, and this is very relevant to the University of Virginia, by the way, had privately printed a little book of poems that he had not yet published, of course. He was not yet a published poet. He made two copies, one for her and one for him, okay? The name of the book was Twilight. And those of you who have a strong connection here to the University of Virginia know that, what?
That it's here.
What?
That it's here, one
yeah,
copy.
Yeah, Seawaller Barrett tracked it down over the years and purchased it. I have no idea what he paid for it, do you?
No.
No. And they keep it in a vault. And if you want to see it, good luck. But it is in a vault, and occasionally on special occasions they bring it upstairs or wherever it is. I don't know, where's the vault?
Just right over there.
Right over there, okay.
You can ask for it any time.
And you're allowed to see it?
Everyone is able to see it.
Oh. Well, I was given a little replica to take home with me. I have it at home. But that is very exciting. He went over to Canton on the train, I'm assuming. He went to the home where she was being treated as a dormitory at that point and went to the door the way I imagine it. Now, I don't know for sure about these facts, but he knocked on the door, and she did not know he was coming because he didn't have instant communication the way we have today. He would have texted her and said, I'm coming, or something. But she was horrified to have him show up there when she was just finishing her third year. And this was 1894, right? And he handed her her copy of Twilight, and he kept one for himself. Well, he didn't like the way she received him. She received him in such a way that he was convinced that she was dating somebody else and had met somebody in college, which was not totally out of the possibilities. So she kind of said, yeah, thank you. See you next year, you know. And so he left, and he took his own copy and destroyed it. He destroyed his own copy, so there was only one copy in existence, and how it got from Eleanor to Seawaller Barrett is sort of another day. But he did find it, and he did buy it, and he did put it in the library here. So he went back home very, very unhappy, and he decided to make his drama real for her. He decided to go down to the Dismal Swamp. Now, the Dismal Swamp is in, you can correct me on this, is it North Carolina or South Carolina?
North. It's in Virginia and North Carolina. I think it goes down from Virginia to North Carolina.
Right. Well, he went and deliberately got himself lost in the Dismal Swamp. And he thought that Eleanor would be very impressed with this show of dismay. And he got lost, and he had some huntsmen came through and captured him. How many minutes do I have each time?
Well, we have to make sure we have time for others to ask questions.
Okay, so I'm going to finish this very quickly. She did graduate, and they did get married in a Swedenborgian ceremony in Lawrence, and he was madly in love with Eleanor, and a lot of his poems, as he always said later, if you look at all my poems, you would know that somehow they're all about her, and that was true. So I'm going to stop here. I could read that one poem about that. Am I allowed to do that?
Absolutely.
Molly.
Shall we hear a poem?
Oh, let me have a poem. Okay. Let me get to that one. Never again would birdsong be the same. He would declare and could himself believe that the birds there and all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their tone an oversound, her tone of meaning but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would birdsong be the same, and to do that to birds is why she came. So that's one of many, many love poems. I think a thing the poet is kind of underrated for. So the poems are the central thing, but Eleanor was critical. I mean, every poem that he wrote, he would share with her, and they would talk about it. Excuse me. And And then, as I mentioned earlier, there were a lot of other women that came into the getting him approved. Amy Lowell, of course, wrote extensively about him and became a family friend. Harriet Monroe and Susan Hayes Ward. Susan Hayes Ward is a real, thank you, appreciate that. Susan Hayes Ward is a very interesting woman that I do write about rather considerably. They became very, very close friends, and she adopted the whole family. He was a teenager when she published My Butterfly in the New York Independent. When she was very old and retired from the New York Independent, because I better do this, she went up to back up to Berwick, Maine, where she was from. And Frost went to visit her just before she died. She was blind and in all kinds of trouble by that time. And her brother had been the editor of the paper, and he had died. But as she was talking to him, she said, "You wrote a poem called Birches, and in that poem you have, it's about a young boy who goes off and has to entertain himself. He doesn't have anyone to play with. And he learns how to break down the birch trees. That's a beautiful poem, and that's wonderful, but you need to have a companion poem about a girl." "Oh," he says, he never did commissioned work, of course, but he loved Susan Hayes Ward and was very grateful to her for all the praise and encouragement that she had given him. So then she told the story of her childhood when she was climbing up a birch tree to get to the wild grapes up on the tree. And her brother was there, and he teased her about climbing the tree. She was a young girl then. And she got caught up there. She couldn't get down. And she was holding onto the branches for dear life. And the brother was teasing her about her inability to get down. Just drop, let go. She couldn't let go. Anyway, she ultimately gets down, and the last few lines of that poem are very beautiful, and I don't have that with me, but that was the only time that he ever wrote it like a commissioned poem. He went home and wrote that about her childhood experience. So that's one that, you know, again, she was wonderful with his family. She took care of him as a poet. So Amy Lowell, and then, of course, my mother, Leslie, was critical to the... She was the strongest one of the children and managed to go in and out with relationships with him, but was very important to his development as well.
So, okay. Leslie, let's take that to Nancy.
Nancy.
The question of biography was a question that bedeviled me from the beginning, honestly, because it didn't take me very long to discover how deep Agnes Martin's resistance to biography really ran. I'm just going to read a bit from the letter she wrote to me, and you'll see what I was up against. "I want to repeat, there are no valid thoughts about art. If your sensibilities are awake, you will respond. It will be a pleasant experience, recalling happy times. You must see that no talking will help and that no defense is necessary and that you must not answer your critics. But most important, you must have no contact with them." She also was very insistent on the idea that there is absolutely nothing to be gained from looking into an artist's life. Molly, you make a really good observation. I found that if I let myself be guided by the idea there's got to be something in here that sheds some light on the art, then maybe there's some value to exploring that aspect of the life. In truth, I found an awful lot of the life absolutely fascinating. I couldn't stay away. And one of the things that was interesting to me because of this long interval between the first time I wrote about her work and the second was that when I was in college in the 70s, you didn't talk about an artist's life if you were considering someone whose work was called minimalist, which hers was at the time without any qualification. It was absolutely prohibited to bring in anything that wasn't a strictly formal response. We talk about the material, we talk about the shape and form, we talk about, you know, the internal organization of the work. The end, which I think is the way, you know, the arts were treated across the board in that period. You know, Clement Greenberg still held sway, a very formal approach to thinking about art. And we've kind of come full circle now, which was also complicating for me because we know too much about artists. It's the thing we go to first, right? You know, and we think we've got the answer when we know something about the artist, not just, you know, gossipy stuff, but when we've heard from the artist, we think we've heard everything we need to know. And it is absolutely critically important to know what artists have to say about their work, but there's no value in, you know, in picking up pen and paper in the first place if there isn't some value as well to a conversation, to, you know, a dialogue that takes place between writer and subject, between writer and subject's production. And a final thing about this question of group biography, which I think is such a big part of your work, your book, Leslie, and it became a big part of mine, is that similarly, between the 70s and, you know, in 2015, all of these communities I thought I knew something about. I lived in the Seaport community, just as it happens, at some point in the 80s. And even then, you know, and there was quite a bit known about the artist community that lived there. A lot of those artists became very famous. Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, really famous. The fact of its self-description as a deliberate alternative to the stuff that was going on uptown on 10th Street with the big brawling, you know, macho guys wasn't discussed. All the stuff that was going on out in Seattle, because it wasn't the East Coast, wasn't discussed. The very important community in New Mexico is not that well known, and I think these are all things that we've really made strides about, that we're not so centered on New York and now New York and Los Angeles, that it's a big country, it's a big world. There's never just one story to tell.
Questions from the audience? Yes. Richard.
Leslie, thank you so much for sharing.
I can't hear.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I'm so glad you shared Never Again with Birdsong, mm-hmm. the same, very important poem. How much is of the portrait of the couple in a poem like Home Burial about your grandparents?
Well, you never read that in public, by the way. It's a very personal poem. Is that what you're asking? I don't know what you're asking, actually.
What's the question?
Do you see your grandparents in that poem?
Oh, the feelings are definitely feelings that he had.
She discusses this in the biography directly.
Not the event itself. It was a neighbor down the street. They did not have a burial site at their home at all. So that's completely from another. And he was writing a poem about a couple down the street, an announcement in the paper about the death of their child, okay? So that doesn't make any difference in the question you're answering. Assume your question is to answer, did he have those feelings? Is that what you're asking? I don't know what you're asking.
Well, the tension that's between the couple and that poem.
Yeah, there are tensions, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess
think any time you have a child die, a young child die in a couple, there are going to be problems. Oh, maybe you've not met any people like that.
No.
You're too young.
No.
You will. losing a child is definitely not a laughing matter. So it leaves an indelible impression, and no two people respond to tragedy in the same way. At least that's been my life experience. Some people become very stoic, and they reach out to other people, and go to grief counseling and all this stuff. But a couple that doesn't do that stuff, they have to work it out. And that's the case where they did work it out, because they were still married when Eleanor died. So there was never any permanent break there or anything. But those are very complicated emotions.
We have time for one more question from the audience.
One
more yes.
question. What did you say?
Was there did Clifford Still and Agnes Martin?
I can't hear.
One another at all? I mean, they both seem both from a similar area in Canada, both kind of stubborn. Well.
Why don't you have a mic?
This question's for Nancy.
Good.
I don't have any information confirming that they knew each other. I think it's possible that he was in Taos at a certain point when she was there, because he was part of a community on the West Coast that there was a summer, now I'm not going to remember the details, but there was a summer when Rothko was in Taos, And Diebenkorn and others who were teaching up on the West Coast had come down to Taos from that, sort of together from having taught together. And it's likely that she met him there, but he was not among her friends.
I think more of just curious kind of art scrabble, kind of gigantic landscape. You know, have some kind of their kind of personality of somewhat being in solitude and very much like the skills interested in controlling the way that his work is seen after he died. Like no cafeteria in the museum and things like that. I mean, it seems maybe it's just an easy association, but just thinking from that.
Absolutely. In terms of character, in terms of the sensibility that is in the work, absolutely.
Well, I'd encourage all of you to continue the conversation in the back of the room after buying a copy of each of these writers' wonderful books. Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you to our panelists.